Everybody. So we continue with more and more realistic models of inflation. Let us start with a quick review of where we ended last time. We said we decomposed the inflaton field into its zero mode, which is constant in space, and the remainder of the field. We treat the zero mode, the part that's constant in space, classically, and the remainder, which is space-dependent, space and time-dependent, of course, we treat quantum mechanically or quantum theoretically. Similarly, we take the metric, and we decompose the metric into a zero mode of it, which is to say, the part that is constant in space in an FRW background, plus a perturbation of it, which is assumed small and which will be quantized. And this part is going to be treated classically. So the classical part of the metric and the classical part of the inflaton field will obey the classical Klein-Gordon equation and the classical Einstein equations, and they will determine then what the background evolution is of the space-time and the background evolution is of the Klein-Gordon field. And by background, I mean the bulk of it, most of it, the dominant part of it, which is assumed constant in space and effectively classical, meaning that the expectation value is way bigger than the uncertain. Now, the fluctuations in the metric, the spatial fluctuations in the metric, can be decomposed into fluctuations of a scalar type, of a vector type, and of a tensor type. And by scalar type, we mean fluctuations that can be expressed in terms of scalar functions, fluctuations that can be expressed in terms of vector-valued functions, and fluctuations that cannot, that are truly tensorial in type. And these were the scalar functions e, b, psi, and phi, the vectorial vector-valued functions v and w, and the truly tensorial remainder h, I, j. So the full metric then, or gives us the full line element invariant distances, infinitesimal invariant distances, in the following way. We get the invariant distance is given by what you get from the unperturbed metric, which is just scale factor squared times the Minkowski space type line element. And then there's a contribution from scalar functions, these guys, the contribution from the vector-valued functions, and the truly tensorial ones. Just to remind you of how they look like, so the scalar part to the line element has contributions from these functions phi and psi and b and e, all of which are some scalar functions. The vector-valued part is obtained by taking a vector-valued function v and a vector-valued function w. And the tensorial part takes this form. Now, these approximations will be put then into, these approximations are then put into the Klein-Gordon, into the action of gravity and the Klein-Gordon field, plus, of course, all the other fields, but we're neglecting that contribution. And when we do that, we obtain, of course, many terms that will contain these scalar functions, etc. But it turns out that these terms can be simplified. Why can they be simplified? Well, it's because in space-time, there is no canonical way in general, no special way, no preferred way to foliate space-time into space-like hypersurfaces. The way we define what is equal time is ambiguous. There's a lot of choice. So there's no preferred choice for a coordinate system. But clearly these functions, psi, phi, a, b, and b and e, etc., all depend on the choice of coordinate system that you make. And it turns out that we can choose coordinate systems, we can choose the foliation of space-time into space-like hypersurfaces in such a way that this collection of functions dramatically simplify. the details, here are some references. And the result is that for small inhomogeneities, so when the perturbation theory is really good and we can just work with first order perturbation theory, that almost all of the inhomogeneous terms can be eliminated by suitable coordinate choice, except there are two fields which are coordinate system and therefore gauge independent. And one of them is the spatial tensor field, Hij, the truly tensorial part of the metric. And remember that the truly tensorial part of the metric that we obtained here, the Hij, represents a contribution to the metric perturbations, which is independent of the energy momentum tensor. Remember, this is just like in electromagnetism. When you have currents and charges, then wherever the currents, wherever the charges are, there is going to be electric and magnetic fields. And that's determined by the inhomogeneous Maxwell equation. But you can also have electromagnetic fields where there are no charges and currents, because they can induce each other. And it can just leak. You can have a charge over here, but it will create an electrostatic field that ranges far away. So there are also vacuum solutions of electromagnetism, meaning no charges, no currents present. And similarly with gravity, there is any perturbation, any distribution of energy and pressure, any energy momentum tensor will create curvature where it is, where the energy momentum tensor is non-zero. But even beyond that, there can be contributions to the metric that are non-trivial. And the Hij is of that kind. Hij describes gravitational waves. And of course, they can exist even where there are no masses. They will just travel even happily through empty space. In addition to these gravitational waves, another degree of freedom that is in these parameters is a spatially scalar field R. Remember, we are talking here about spatial scalars, spatial vectors, spatial tensors. So another degree of freedom that is still there that cannot be gauged away by no matter what choice of slicing we make of space-time into space-like hypersurfaces is this so-called Mukhanov field R. And this Mukhanov field R is made out of, it's a linear combination of both the Klein-Gordon fields perturbations and the metric fields perturbation. Namely, due to the Einstein equation, we have that the fluctuations of the inflaton field generate fluctuations of the energy momentum tensor, which then generate fluctuations of the metric. Or vice versa, you can read the same equation also the other way around, and then you can say that because we have this type of fluctuations in the metric, there must be fluctuation of that kind in the energy momentum tensor. The main point being that the Einstein equation relates these two types of degrees of freedom. We would normally think of the fluctuations of a field to be independent from the fluctuations of the metric. But because the Einstein equation says this is equal to that, it actually says there's one degree of freedom. There's one degree of freedom. If one of them fluctuates, the other one has to too. It's the same thing, really. And it manifests itself explicitly, and it's a rather lengthy calculation to prove that this is the case. But I will try to give you at least a good intuition for why that's the right way. So the combination of the scalar fluctuations and the metric fluctuation that is gauge independent, that is to first order independent of how you slice your space-time into space-like hypersurfaces, is this particular linear combination. It had to be something of that kind, right? We know that the inflaton field itself cannot be the only way to look at this, because it is set equal to, when it fluctuates, it creates fluctuations of the energy momentum tensor, which then through the Einstein equation are coupled to fluctuations of the metric. So there's got to be an intimate relationship between fluctuations of the metric, at least particular kinds of fluctuations of the metric, scalar types of fluctuations of the metric, and the scalar fluctuations of the inflatron field. And as it happens, this particular linear combination is what is really fluctuating. Let us look at this more closely. Let's ask, why this factor here? Why this prefactor? And how far can we push it? In the sense that we know this is the physical quantity, these are the fluctuations that matter. They are independent of how you choose your slicing of space-time into space-like hypersurfaces. But what happens if we change the slicing? This will not change, right? But these individual contributions will change. Let's look at that. Okay, so physically, what is this Mokanov variable? It's not actually a variable, right? It's a field. But for some reason, it's called the Mokanov variable. So one of the two terms, this one, is the scalar matrix fluctuation. Remember, this capital psi field is one of the four scalar functions that went into the expression for the scalar type fluctuations of the metric. It's the only one that survived after exploiting all of the freedom that we have in choosing coordinate systems. And this, of course, is the part of the inflatron field which is space dependent. Right? We had split off the zero mode, the zero momentum mode, the part that's constant in space. This is the scalar inflatron field. Contribution to the fluctuation. And somehow the two of them combine to give us something that's gauge invariant. Now, let us look at two extreme ways of slicing space-time into space-like hypersurfaces. Roughly speaking, exactly speaking, what you can do is that you can choose your slicing of space-time into space-like hypersurfaces such that this term goes away and only that one survives. Or you choose your space-like hypersurfaces such that this one goes away and only that one survives. And what this means is that we can choose these fluctuations to be either entirely fluctuations of curvature on your equal time space-like hypersurface, or if you slice space-time differently, then these fluctuations are entirely fluctuations of the field and not of the metric. So case A is this. We foliate in such a way that on surfaces of equal time, one has that the inflatron field doesn't change. So in this case, the phi is vanishing, and the points of equal value of the inflatron field have equal value of time.
I have a question. So mm-hmm. When you say you chose a gauge already, right? Does that mean that in this particular set of choices, you already make gravitational wave a plane wave already?
Oh, wait.
It's a different gauge, right?
Maybe what we're talking about here is the second type of surviving degrees of freedom, right? There is this, the gravitational waves, and then there is that part. And so we're not talking about this one at all. We're just talking about this part now, right? Which is you can think of the psi as being like a local bloating of space.
It's like a small perturbation to the, it's like the Newtonian.
The intrinsic, kind of. Yes, it's the intrinsic curvature, right. The intrinsic curvature fluctuation. So it's unrelated to gravitational waves. If you take a particular volume and you let the gravitational wave go through it, let's say it's a ball, then the gravitational wave will make it briefly into an ellipsoid.
But the volume doesn't change.
Yeah, the volume doesn't change. But the intrinsic curvature will change the volume.
In what sense is that a scalar if you can change the coordinates and get rid of it?
It's a spatial scalar. It's only a spatial scalar, not a space-time scalar. That will be very important in what we will discuss now. Just wait a bit, and I actually have a photograph that tries to illustrate the difference. Okay. So, anybody seen the photograph yet?
I'm expecting it's like a boat or something, or a submarine.
No boat this time, and no cork, but water, sure. I can't do without water. Okay, all right, so one way of slicing our space-time that is going to be very useful is to choose our space-like hypersurfaces in such a way that equal time means equal value of the inflaton field. For this to work out, you can already see something is important has to happen, which is that the inflaton field has a trend. Right? If this was the sitter space, we wouldn't be able to do this, right? Because it would just be constant. If it wasn't slow roll, but if it was just stagnant at the same level, phi, we couldn't use the value of phi as a time. But if we have some slow roll, if it actually does decay, then we can use that as a time. So if we do that, then the Mukhanov variable consists only of the intrinsic curvature fluctuation. And there are no fluctuations of the inflaton field, just by our choice of slicing. So in this case, we would just have intrinsic curvature fluctuations, like a local floating. Volume is locally a little bit increased. It's what is called Gaussian curvature. Now, alternatively, we could also foliate our spacetime in such a way that we have on surfaces of equal time, we have that this psi variable, not the var phi, but the psi variable is equal to zero. And psi, if you remember, was that Gaussian curvature. It was that intrinsic curvature. So in this case, along each equal time surface, there is no bloating of the space-time. It is just totally flat, except possibly for gravitational wave. But as far as the bloating is concerned, as far as this intrinsic curvature is concerned, there is none, no fluctuations of that. Instead, the inflaton field now fluctuates. And so the Mukhanov variable comes out the same anyway. But the way that it is composed of the two contributions has changed now. Remember again how the Mukhanov variable looks like. The Mukhanov variable is a linear combination of the inflaton field's perturbations and the intrinsic curvature fluctuations with this somewhat weird prefactor here. Why is there this prefactor? And why does it have this particular form? See, it's not a harmless prefactor necessarily because, well, let's see, how does it look like? We have the scale factor. You see, the zero here just means that it belongs, it's the scale factor of the FRW model. It's of the zero mode, right, which has no spatial variation. Same with the inflaton field, phi naught, right? That's just the zero mode, the thing that we treat as classical. Let us look what these things are. We have a naught prime divided by a naught. Well, if this is something like the sitter inflation, then that would be a constant. That would be a constant. Or if it's not exactly the sitter, then if it's some slow roll, it wouldn't change very quickly, because that would be something like the Hubble parameter here. This term is 1 over phi naught prime. That's a little dangerous here, this term, because it's 1 divided by the slope of phi as a function of time. So as long as the evolution is a slow roll evolution, that's fine. Because then phi naught prime is some finite value. But if we had exact de Sitter, then phi naught prime would be zero. Right? If the potential was just flat, the field would just stay where it is. Or let's say if it sits in the minimum or something like that, the minimum is zero. If it's set at the bottom of a potential or something like this. So there is a bit of a risk. If it wasn't slow roll, if it was completely horizontal, then that phi naught prime would be zero. But we have one divided by zero then, and that whole thing blows up. So let's see, get to the bottom of this, because it tells us that actually what we are doing right now and what we did in the previous lecture, strictly speaking, cannot be applied to the Sitter space. Okay, so let's see, how does this contribution come about? The full derivation would take a lot of space, but let's at least get some intuition for why it has to have that form. So why that particular prefactor? So the inflat, let's look at what we have here. So when the inflatons inhomogeneities imply locally varying expansion rates by the Einstein equation. So some regions are ahead, some others lag behind in their expansion. Right, so you can imagine space-time is expanding, and in some places it expands a little faster than in others, just because of a fluctuation. Now, when we change the space-time slicing from equal time meaning equal phi value, that was case A, to equal time meaning equal curvature value, then we are turning pure intrinsic curvature into which is local bloating, so delta A over A. It's a fluctuation of the scale factor. Notice there's no zero here. It's a fluctuation of the scale factor divided by the scale factor. That's the local bloating that we have, local because there's an x dependence here, into pure inflaton fluctuation. Right? As we said, we can slice spacetime one way or the other. We have either only curvature fluctuations or only inflaton fluctuation. So let's do a simple argument here. A fluctuation of local bloating here, delta A over A, that's an expression that we had coming up in here, right? We had here. This was global, but we're looking at it locally now. What is this expression? How does this come about? I mean, the full expression, let me just show it again, is this one. This is the full expression. How would that come about? Here we have a fluctuation of the, let me try to rephrase the question more accurately. Here we have a fluctuation of the metric. A local bloating. How can that be the same thing as a local fluctuation of the inflaton field? We need to translate, we need to change slicing in such a way that we see that this is of the same kind as that. And there's this prefactor in between that makes them of the same kind. So, this being a local bloating, a local change in the expansion. Let us look at that. So let us consider delta A over A. This is 1 over A, and then the delta A by the chain rule, we just symbolically write it as delta A by d phi, delta phi. It's the chain rule. But then we can apply this chain rule again, and then we have 1 over A, that's just carried forward. And then instead of writing dA by d phi, we write dA by d eta by d phi by d phi and a delta phi. So that is 1 over a carried forward. This is an a prime. And here we have 1 over eta prime. 1 over eta prime, delta phi. So what we see is that a local bloating corresponds to this prefactor times a local fluctuation of the inflaton field. So what are the ramifications of this then? Ramification of this is that the intrinsic curvature inhomogeneity can become very strongly enhanced. And we can read it off from this term that we would get tremendously large fluctuations if this phi naught prime gets small. So if the slow roll becomes slower roll and very slow roll and eventually just horizontal, then this would seem to become very large. In fact, it doesn't become very large. The conclusion we should draw from this going to zero is not that that becomes large. The conclusion we should draw is that our perturbation theory breaks down because these terms are too large. So this happens for the sitter inflation, right? In the sitter inflation, we have a of t is e to the power ht. And therefore, a dot over a is the Hubble constant, is constant. And if it's just approximately the sitter, then the Hubble constant becomes a Hubble parameter. And so the field is approximately constant in this case. Remember that the relationship between the field and the Hubble parameter was given in this way. And remember, the field contributes to the energy momentum tensor in a particular way. And then the energy density plays the role of the cosmological constant, which normally goes into here. And from that, we were able to read off that potential, if it dominates over the kinetic terms, the potential produces a Hubble parameter of this form, basically the square root of the potential. So, yeah?
For the last case, isn't that also the case for early phase of slow roll inflation?
Early phase oscillatory?
No, like at the beginning of slow roll inflation, the potential is also almost flat, right? Doesn't that mean your slow roll doesn't work?
It could be, but there is no reason why it should necessarily start out flat. You're right, if it's, for example, if it were the Higgs particle, then you would start off where it is horizontal. But we don't actually know how the potential really looks like.
Also, we just need to care about once it starts tapering.
Yeah. Right, so we have a problem when phi prime is approximately zero, which is to say we have a problem if we are having approximately the sitter inflation. And it's not that the fluctuations get truly out of hand, it's just that the perturbation theory blows up. And I already explained that in this calculation that we just did, it's this term here, the d eta by d phi, or the inverse of d phi by d eta, so the phi prime, goes to zero, and therefore that term blows up, and then therefore the Mukhanov variable would seem to become very, very large. What that means is, how exactly does the perturbation theory then break down? You see, the Mukhanov variable is gauge invariant only under small changes of coordinate system. And what that means is that the two cases, A and B, the case where either the slicing is such that the inflaton field is constant and the metric is fluctuating, and the case B, where the metric is constant and the inflaton field is fluctuating, the two slicings shouldn't be too different. There shouldn't be too much time lag, so to speak, between the one slicing and the other slicing. But you see, if phi prime is very small, it means d eta by d phi is very large. But d eta by d phi can be thought of as the distance between the two slicing. So you have one space-like hypersurface and another space-like hypersurface. If there were no fluctuations, it would be the same. But with the fluctuations, they're not the same. And so, in particular, those slices would then fluctuate away from each other, and the gap in between could be large, very large. And that means that the perturbation theory that was used to derive that the Mukhanov variable is actually a gauge invariant doesn't apply. You would have to go to higher order, and we don't. So we have to be careful in this analysis that we remain in the regime where the assumptions of the perturbation theory are actually valid. This is analogous to, and here's the water again, to this. You see, the picture we have is this. Imagine that we choose, let's say, this a slicing of space-time in such a way that there are no fluctuations in the phi field, but there are fluctuations in the metric, or the other way around. Now, how do you go from the one to the other? Well, let's say we have fluctuations. We have no fluctuations in the metric, but we have fluctuations in the inflaton field. Then how do we change the slicing, our coordinate system, to not have fluctuations in the inflaton field? Well, if we have a slow roll, we know that if we wait long enough, the inflaton field is going to diminish. We know that overall, if we go back in time, the inflaton field goes up. Therefore, no matter what the inflaton field is at the moment, we want to change coordinates such that it reaches a certain target value that is the target value of phi for the space-like hypersurface that we now design. If we are under the target value, it just means we have to slice a little bit towards the path where the inflaton field was still larger. If we are above the, if the phi field is above the target value, we just have to slice a little bit towards the future so that, you know, on average, the phi field goes down. And in this way, we can always do it. But you see, if space-time, if we were not in a slow roll regime, but in a steady regime like the sitter itself, then there's no guarantee that if you go left or right, you know, you might have to go arbitrarily far and it gets out of hand. The faster the slow roll is, the smaller is the difference between, I mean, the smaller adjustments do you have to make to get to equal phi values, because the phi values overall change pretty quickly, right? So you can easily correct for any phi deviations by just doing a little bit of a detour either in the past or towards the future in your new slicing. And in the case of a river coming down from a mountain range, it's similar. Imagine you have a mountain range, it creates a river, and now that river enters a plain. If that plain has some gentle slope, the river will follow that slope down to the ocean. But now make that slope very gentle, right? It's almost flat. Well, then the river doesn't quite know which way to go to the ocean, right? And it will meander. And the flatter the plain is, the more the river will meander. If the plain was actually completely flat, you'd end up with a lake. It wouldn't be at a river, right? It would just regularly fill up everywhere. And so similarly, the sitter would be the lake. The sitter would be there in a way. Right? So we do actually need some slow roll in order for the whole framework here to work out.
So basically what you're doing is defining some like thermodynamic arrow of time?
I wouldn't call it thermodynamic, but yeah. Yeah, in effect, we choose the phi field to indicate time. Actually, you could also choose the scale factor to indicate time. That's exactly the two choices, A or B, right? If you use phi as your clock, then equal phi values or equal time values. Or if you choose the scale factor as your clock, then equal scale factor is your time. And in principle, there is no preference between the two. But as we will see in a moment, there actually is a preference between the two. The gauge invariance is broken at the end of inflation. Not during inflation, but at the end of it, it is. So could this be a problem? Well, we know that we know the size of R. We know the size of the fluctuations of the Mukhanov variable, assuming inflation is right. We can match the model to the experimental data, and we find that the curvature fluctuations, or we can call them inflaton fluctuations, it depends on how you want to write it, are of order 10 to the minus 5 at the end of inflation because of the size of the temperature fluctuations in the CMB. Also, there is actually evidence in the record of the CMB which shows that the Hubble radius, I mean, assuming inflation is right, it shows that the Hubble radius actually increased during inflation, which is to say that during inflation, the fluctuations generated, or better said, the fluctuations frozen at horizon crossing, actually diminished in amplitude. Those modes who crossed the Hubble horizon first had larger quantum fluctuations frozen in than those modes who crossed the Hubble horizon later. And that is what you would expect for slow roll inflation. Because what it says is that initially, the inflaton potential is a larger value, and then you slowly roll down to smaller values of the inflaton potential. When the inflaton potential is large, the Hubble constant or the Hubble parameter is large. But 1 over the Hubble parameter is the size of the horizon. So slow roll inflation says that the potential slowly diminishes, which means that the Hubble horizon slowly increases. When inflation ends, the Hubble horizon is infinite. Everybody can communicate with everybody again. So the prediction then would be this, that remember, first of all, let me remind you that the smaller the Hubble horizon is, larger are the quantum fluctuations that will be imprinted on the CMB and will be imprinted in the distribution of galaxies and so on. And the reason is, you remember, quantum fields fluctuate with the usual statistics as in Minkowski space while they are still very short wavelength. Right? So as long as the wavelength of a quantum field is shorter than the Hubble horizon, they behave just like modes on Minkowski space, which means so L 1 over K this is delta phi, the size of the fluctuations as a function of K. We have that as long as modes have a wavelength which is short compared to the Hubble length, let's call this L Hubble, then we have this 1 over L behavior, right? Which means large quantum fluctuations for short wavelengths and smaller quantum fluctuations at large wavelengths. We normally don't see quantum fluctuations at wavelengths of a galaxy or even a meter. And normally this just goes further down and asymptotes here towards the axis so that for large distances there are small quantum fluctuations to be observed on. But then we calculated that as soon as a mode has a wavelength that exceeds, that starts exceeding the Hubble radius, the Hubble horizon size, and every mode reaches that at some point because it expands with the universe, then actually this completely flattens out and we have that the quantum fluctuations amplitude stays the same. So even though their wavelengths may soon be of intergalactic size, the quantum fluctuations are still of the amplitude that they had when the modes were at extremely, extremely short wavelength, even just 5 orders of magnitude from the Planck length. That's the trick by which you get huge fluctuations, I mean, not huge, but of the order 10 to the minus 5, even at cosmological sizes. And if this horizon changed over time, right? So slow roll inflation means that the Hubble horizon slowly increased, which means that at a later time, there we go, at a later time, the LH later is here, which means that these modes that cross the Hubble horizon later, they will have had more of a decay until it flattens out. So modes that cross the Hubble horizon later cross it when the Hubble horizon is larger, so their fluctuations have already diminished more. So the fluctuation size that we see at the end of inflation is diminished. And as I said, there's evidence for that already in the WMAP and Planck data.
Wait, so in the WMAP data, you can actually see the Hubble horizon changing?
I'm not sure how strong the evidence is, but for the Planck, I'm pretty sure that they say they see the slope. They have some estimate for how big the slope is. In fact, it's not just the linear part, but they say they can model better than just the linear part. So they do basically a Taylor expansion of it, which they then translate into a Taylor expansion of what the potential does. Because the potential, how the spectrum, the shape of the spectrum is very closely related to the shape of the potential. So then, what I wanted to say here is that we seem to be lucky here, that we're in a safe territory with the fluctuations being of order 10 to the minus 5, that we can actually do the perturbation theory. But it didn't have to come out this way. So inflation is it's sufficiently different from De Sitter for us to be able to do the perturbation theory. Now, what about the slicings of space-time into space-like hypersurfaces one way or the other? Should we use the value of the inflaton field as a clock, or should we use the value of the scale factor as a clock? These are the two cases. And during inflation, it doesn't matter. There is no preferred choice. But the end of inflation singles out one of them. And the reason is that the end of inflation is determined by the value of phi. See, when phi makes the potential fall off the cliff, it is the potential that determines when inflation ends. And so, in that sense, there is a preferred frame then, which is to say that if we interview different places in the universe and ask them, when did inflation come to an end? They would answer, well, when the phi field dropped and the potential dropped. And then I ended up with this phi field. That's when it ended here. And you ask them, where did phi field drop? Which means that the end of inflation is a hypersurface of constant phi, but of variable curvature fluctuations. The expansion factor, the scale factor has variations there.
Sorry, I don't get that sentence. Choosing a slicing is supposed to be not a physical, as in like, it's a freedom, right? Not a physics thing, right? So
yeah, we can always choose any one we want, but what I'm saying is that maybe I should have spelled that out. When inflation ended, something physical happened, which is that the energy that was in the potential turned into the product or was used for the production of particles that then filled the universe with a hot plasma. And that process was triggered at a particular phi value, right? It was literally the dropping of the phi that made the dropping of the potential that created all the particles, which then observed, of course, because they can act as spectators. They decohere the fluctuation. I mean, it is thought that the fluctuations decohered earlier already, but this is a time at which a snapshot is taken of the fluctuations. So we end up at the end of inflation with a gas which is conveniently described by at one time having the same value of phi but different values of the gravitational potential. So you have imprint. So you start a big bang which is filled with a hot plasma, where you have fluctuations in the metric in there, but not fluctuations in the phi.
So if I choose a constant curvature slicing instead of the constant phi slicing,
then you would find that in some regions inflation has ended, in others it hasn't.
Everyone disagrees when.
That's right.
Okay.
That's right. Okay, so now the action. We take the Einstein action, we take the Klein-Gordon action, we neglect the other part. They must be expanded to a second order in the inhomogeneities in order to obtain their equations of motion to first order, to get the linear equations of motion there. So what do we get? What we should expect is that things are relatively straightforward for the gravitational waves, because they don't couple to anybody. They just are, the gravitational waves are much like the inflaton field that we considered earlier. The gravitational waves are not coupled to the Einstein equation to any other sources or so. It's just waves that can quantum fluctuate in the way that we described earlier. On the other hand, there is also the scalar degrees of freedom, which is the inflaton fields perturbation together with the intrinsic curvature fluctuations, which combine to form the Mukhanov variable. And so what we should expect is that the Mukhanov variable, being a hybrid thing, will have a somewhat non-trivial equation of motion, but the gravitational waves should have a more conventional equation of motion. So let's see how this comes out. So if we take the Einstein action and the Klein-Gordon action and we expand everything to second order, what we obtain is that the scalar part, so the hybrid variable, the Mukhanov variable, has this action. It can be put into this form. Now, let us look at what form that has. It's a function z squared of eta, which will play the role of the scale factor, but it is not the scale factor. And then we have here the derivative of the Mukhanov variable, derivative of the Mukhanov variable, and then the eta metric. This action looks exactly like the action of a Klein-Gordon field on an FRW spacetime, except that for a Klein-Gordon field, there should be the scale factor a squared, but it isn't. It's z squared. That's where the non-triviality comes in that z instead of a. The Mukhanov variable has a slightly modified kind of Klein-Gordon equation. Now, what is the substitute for the scale factor for the Mukhanov variable? The substitute for the scale factor, the z of eta, is a naught squared over a naught prime times phi naught prime. Remember what this is? This is the scale factor, the bulk scale factor. It's the zero mode of it, squared divided by its derivative with respect to the conformal time. And here we have the bulk part of the inflaton field. All of these are classical things because they are just the zero mode, right? This is just only time-dependent things because they're zero modes. They're constant in space. So the calculational status of this is, if you remember, we separate the Klein-Gordon field into a zero mode that we treat classically and the fluctuations that we treat quantumly, and similarly for the metric. And then, as far as the algorithm is concerned, we first calculate the solution to the Einstein equation and the Klein-Gordon equation for the zero mode. And that gives us then a background Klein-Gordon field living on a background metric. And then having that, we calculate the quantum fluctuations of the perturbations to the inflaton field, perturbations to the metric, where, as we just found out, actually we have to calculate the combination of the degrees of freedom, called the Mukhanov variable. That's the gauge invariant thing, calculate, and the gravitational wave. So with this algorithm, this is already done in an earlier step. Right? We already calculated the solution to the Einstein equation and the Klein-Gordon equation. so we can assume that we already know how the scale factor behaves in time and how the Klein-Gordon field behaves in time. And by that, I mean the zero modes of them, the classical parts of them. So this can be calculated. That goes into here. And then we are in the situation that we treated all along in this course. Scale factor is given. Now we calculate the quantum Klein-Gordon equation for that. So we can apply all of our machinery to this. We can calculate the quantum field theory of that. And all of the usual results will apply. Horizon crossing, freezing of modes, this business, all of that will apply, except we have to be careful that this is not the scale factor, but it's a somewhat modified version of it. But it's not completely different from the scale factor. Let us look at what it actually is. So what we have is a naught divided by a naught prime, which is approximately constant, and this thing can also be constant. The values are quite non-trivial, but in practice, you get that a naught over a naught prime will not change much, and that will not change much, so it's just a naught here. So actually, it is more or less a naught. What it actually plays out to be, and how that impacts the predicted quantum fluctuations of the Mokanov field, we will see later. There will be some subtle things to do with horizon crossing. So this action is very similar to the action that we calculated all along in this course, except that at the time we were working with the entire Klein-Gordon field, not caring about how it might relate to the scalar part of the metric, and we had the scale factor here. Now we see that we should really do is calculate a very similar theory, the same exact same structure, but not the scale factor here, but instead this function z of eta.
I have a question. So is this action supposed to be the equation, supposed to give equation of motion of delta phi?
No, no. Now we're saying that's wrong. We did this all course, all along the course. We said this is what we do, Klein-Gordon field on a curved background in FRW spacetime. And now we're saying that's actually wrong. And the reason is that the Klein-Gordon field combines with the scalar part of the metric to form one degree of freedom, which is the Mokanov variable. And the equation of motion that we have to calculate for it is derived from that action here, where this is the new scale factor given by that.
So right? Essentially you cannot treat it as a phi in the usual field plus some perturbation and then just shove it into the usual action. No, you can't do that, right?
Well, we did that, and when we do that, we find that terms combine, and what is the gauge invariant quantity is the linear combination of these perturbations of the... I mean, basically, it's... it's the non-zero modes of this combined with the scalar part of the metric. Right. Okay, but the good news is that the machinery that we used applies exactly. It's just that we have to modify here this. And the interpretation is a little bit more subtle too, because we now know that the Mokanov variable can be interpreted as describing fluctuations of the inflaton field, if you want, or also can be interpreted as the fluctuations of the intrinsic curvature. In fact, if we always commit to using a slicing of space-time into space-like hypersurfaces of equal phi, then strictly speaking, that's still true, right? Because then we have the other way around. If we slice space-time in such a way that equal time means equal scale factor, then all fluctuations are in the inflaton field. The Mokanov variable becomes just phi. Right? We could do that. But now we know it's actually more subtle, and if we allow ourselves more general slicings of space-time, then it's the Mokanov variable that we should really work with. Okay. So secondly then, the other degree of freedom is that of gravitational waves, of the Hij. And the gravitational waves have this action, if you just collect the terms up to quadratic order in the action, it's this action. It looks perhaps a little complicated, but it is not. It is entirely of the kind that we have discussed so far in this course. Because let's look at it. It's hij, hij.
Is there summation over hij?
Yes, there's, yes.
Ij?
Ij, yes, there is. Okay. I'll get to the polarizations in a moment. And then we have the scale factor squared here. And then we have the item in U. So it's exactly the usual Klein-Gordon action, but just for each of those components of hij. And this prefactor doesn't really change anything. It's just a numerical factor here. So what we see is that the gravitational waves behave exactly the way that we thought Klein-Gordon fields would behave. Now remember that the hij are not completely arbitrary matrices. For example, they have to be symmetric because the metric is. But more than that, they have to be traceless, etc. So let us now quantize R and H, the Mukhanov variable and the gravitational wave. The equations of motion can be easily read off from the actions that we had. We already calculated the Klein-Gordon equation for the action of a scalar field on FRW spacetimes, and we can just recycle what we did previously. And what we find is that this is the Klein-Gordon equation for the Mukhanov variable. Notice there is this friction term, and we know already how we can undo the friction term by going to a new variable, the one that we used to call chi, but another new variable for r, so, you know, just by multiplying it with the scale factor. Such that in the terms of the new variable, this friction term is going to go away. Other than that, I mean, it's just the same procedure. And for the tensor fields, again, same thing. This is the equation of motion, again, with the friction term here. And again, we can play the same trick and get rid of the friction term. So here's how we did this in the past. We took the Klein-Gordon field, multiplied it with the scale factor, and got this auxiliary field chi, which no longer had a friction term. But the price to pay was, or the way that the non-triviality re-emerged, was that the chi field then was described by a Klein-Gordon equation in co-moving momentum space, which had a time-dependent mass term. I mean, this is now without an actual mass term, but it's the effectively, this is where the mass also would be. So it's a k squared minus a double prime over a. And of course, this means that this term can dominate over that one. And that is when the harmonic oscillator flips its sign and we have horizon crossing. Now, for the scalar field, we will now do this trick for the Mukhanov variable, and then we will do it for the gravitational waves as well. For the Mukhanov variable, for the scalar component of our degrees of freedom, we have that the action, that in the action, the scale factor A is replaced by this function Z, which remember is known. It's expressed in terms of A and phi naught, A naught and phi naught. So since the scale factor is replaced by Z, we also need to replace the A here by Z. So we take the Mukhanov variable, multiply it with Z, and we get a new variable U, which is useful because its equation of motion doesn't have a friction term, and we get the usual calculation. There is a minus sign in here, and that's just there for historic reasons. Some author introduced a minus sign there, and it stuck. There's really no good reason to define a minus sign into this.
It's not convenient.
It's convenient in the sense that you conveniently don't contradict the literature if you do it. But it's tedious. OK. So then what we obtain for the Mukhanov variables, auxiliary variable, is that it obeys this Klein-Gordon equation, where now we have Z double prime over Z. And that means that horizon crossing is not exactly happening at the same time as it is happening for this case or for the gravitational waves. Because for the gravitational waves, you can already anticipate that things will be simpler. Because we don't have to replace A by Z. For gravitational waves, it's just going to be the same. namely here the tensor fields, tensor components, gravitational waves. For the gravitational waves, we have here the gravitational waves Hij, that tensor. And if we just multiply it with A, then we get rid of the friction term. Again, in the literature, somebody found it wise to put this prefactor in here. You don't have to, but yeah, then you don't have to write the prefactor elsewhere, right? So that's the logic. I don't know why I wrote convenient, but in any case, that's a standard definition that you put this prefactor in here. The overall idea is exactly the same. This variable, in terms of this variable, the equation will not have a friction term. Remember that the Klein-Gordon equation is linear. Therefore, it doesn't matter if you put that in here, that will cancel out of the Klein-Gordon equation. You could multiply with another factor of a million, and it would still get rid of the friction term. Okay, so the equation of motion for the gravitational waves, therefore, looks like this. Remember, the P is the auxiliary field to the gravitational waves field. What are these noises? Did you hear that? Yeah, maybe just leave this open a little bit so that it ventilates a bit better.
Structure?
Sounds like a vent, yeah. Okay. All right, so we now have the frictionless equations of motion for the Mukhanov variable and for the gravitational waves. Now, let us clean up something here. It looks as if we had here 9 different components for the gravitational fields, because Pij has 3 values for I, 3 values for j, right? But of course we don't. We have much fewer. Because if you remember, the Hij couldn't be just anything. We have already taken away from the gravitational wave, from the perturbations of the metric, we've already taken away all the scalar components, all the vector components. So there's just a remnant of what the metric can do, and there are constraints on these remnants. These remnants have the property that they're symmetric, well, of course, because the metric is, but also traceless, and we have this statement here, that the derivatives of the gravitational wave tensors vanish here, which is, in momentum space, this condition here, because the derivative operator becomes multiplication with the momentum. And what that means is that since k is the direction of the wave in question, it means that the projection of your gravitational wave tensor onto the longitudinal direction is vanishing. So that's the condition that tells us that gravitational waves are transversal waves, just like electromagnetic waves are transversal. They don't propagate. They don't have oscillations in the direction of propagation. If, for example, you gave electromagnetism a mass, so if you added a mass term to the Maxwell equations, then the electromagnetic field would acquire a longitudinal degree of freedom. And if that mass was in any way significant, we would know about it, because thermodynamically, every polarization contributes 1/2 kT. And so we would know that extra third. The Planck spectrum would be different by a third.
Oh, this one, you were mentioning that the scalar part you already took away, right? Doesn't mean that you have to implement the TT gauge first before you do this, or the transverse traceless gauge. You have to do it first before you do this step.
That's not a gauge. This is coming from splitting off the scalar and the vector path. Then all of these things have to follow. Let me finish what I wanted to say about electromagnetism. Right? So I just told you that electromagnetic field has 2 polarizations, right? 2 orthogonal, 2 independent polarizations. You can choose them this way, that way, whatever, right? I should say this way and that way, or that way and that way, right? So it has 2 independent polarizations. And that means that in the black body spectrum that Planck calculated, there's a factor of 2. if photons had a mass, they would have also a longitudinal degree of freedom, which would also acquire just as much heat. Therefore, there would be a factor of 3 in the Planck spectrum, where now there's a factor of 2. So there's the difference of 50%. Therefore, it has been argued, we know for sure that photons don't have a mass. Because if they had a mass, the Planck spectrum would be different by 50%. We would surely know about this. But maybe let me just make that comment. Weinberg figured out or made the point that not correct this argument, not entirely. Because if the mass of the photons was sufficiently small, it would take maybe longer than the age of the universe for the longitudinal degree of freedom to thermalize. Because the coupling to the longitudinal degree of freedom would be so much suppressed. So it's not automatic that just because we have a longitudinal degree of freedom, it would also thermalize. You know, things like that might come up also in the issue of gravitational waves. Right. I'm working with Peter on something like that, so just nodding over there. Okay. Right. Okay, so as I said, k is the vector of the points in the direction in which the k propagates. So the equation, this one, means that hij has no component in the propagation direction. Therefore, hij describes transversal waves, like, for example, tectonic shear waves, and not longitudinal waves. I just wanted to give you an example here. For example, when an earthquake happens, then all kinds of waves are being produced. For example, you can have that rock presses against rock, presses against rock. So you have pressure waves, and they would be scalar in their nature. But you can also have that rock twists against rock. And then that rock twists against rock. And so you have this twist propagating. And these would be shear waves. And it turns out that the propagation of shear waves is very different from the propagation of pressure waves. For example, you can't have shear waves in a liquid. Right? Because a liquid, by definition, doesn't restore shear. That is what makes a liquid. It doesn't restore shear. And so the speed of propagation and the dispersion relations and everything is different in general between scalar and tensorial waves, such as these shear waves, which, for example, is being used to find out how deep the crust of the Earth is. I know when you send an acoustic signal there, for example, from an explosion, then, well, the pressure waves will go right through the crust into the liquid interior and propagate through the Earth. But the shear waves will be reflected off the solid liquid boundary, and so we can tell how deep that is. Okay, so at the end of the day, when we consider all those constraints on the Hij matrix, we find out it actually has only 2 degrees of freedom rather than 9. And they are called 2 polarization degrees of freedom. Let's call them lambda equal 1 and lambda equal 2, for example. And then we can do a polarization decomposition. So we write the Pij. Remember, the Pij is the same as the Hij, except for this prefactor that gets rid of the friction term. So we can write this as a sum of 2 terms for 2 polarization modes, and with what we might call mode functions, they're just another way of writing down our not yet quantized gravitational waves, multiplied with matrices epsilon ij, where the matrices epsilon ij provide a basis in the space of polarizations. And they have to be orthogonal, and they have to be symmetric, and traceless, and transversal. And in this way, what we obtain is that we have a Klein-Gordon equation then for these gravitational wave amplitude functions v, vk1 and vk2, which obey individually the Klein-Gordon equation. So it turns out that the 2 polarization modes of gravitational waves obey exactly the Klein-Gordon equation that we have studied all along in this course. because it's actually the scale factor that goes into here and nothing else. So we can simply solve everything the way we did earlier, and then we just have to do all the substitutions backwards. Once we have these fluctuations of the V, we get the fluctuations of the P, we get the fluctuations of the H, etc., etc.
How did the Z turn into an A?
Oh, remember that the Z is in the Klein-Gödel equation for the Mukhanov variable. Because the Mukhanov variable is this hybrid. But the gravitational waves never had a Z. It was always just the A.
Right.
Right. So we have this variable U, which was this auxiliary variable that obeys the Klein-Gödel equation without friction term with the Z instead of the scale, instead of the scale factor. And using it, we want to calculate the quantum fluctuations of the Mukhanov variable. And then using these Pij or Vij, V1 and V2 lambda that we just defined, we want to calculate what the quantum fluctuations are of the gravitational waves. So we really quantize these two, and then we just substitute in back the variables that, I mean, that we are interested in, to get the fluctuations of the Mukhanov variable and the gravitational waves. And the Mukhanov variable will determine what the temperature fluctuations leads to a prediction for the quantum, for the temperature fluctuations in the CMB. And this will lead to a prediction to, of the polarization distribution in the CMB, where this has been measured and that has been claimed to be measured, but inconclusive. So far. All right, so what do we need to do? We need to do the quantum field theory of these and then run the quantum field theory until the end of inflation. And then at the end of inflation, it is as if a measurement was taking place because all those particles were produced out of the energy density of the inflaton field. And then you had this hot Big Bang beginning. You had, I mean, from there on, you could say it's a hot Big Bang because it's hot, the universe is filled with a very hot plasma, and with imprinted on it intrinsic curvature fluctuations, real intrinsic curvature fluctuations, because they've been observed by all the matter in there. So we need to be careful here, because we cannot simply directly use what we calculated before. First of all, can't really use the sitter without being super careful. It has to be a little bit slow roll. And also, it shouldn't be the scale factor for the Mukhanov variable. We should work with the variable Z instead. Okay, so the expectation is then that fluctuations of the Mukhanov variable will give us local space-time expansion, because it's intrinsic curvature. And therefore, if it's in the case of expansion, a little bit of a cooling. And if it's a contraction, a little bit of a heating. Or actually, you should think of it as, well, 300,000 years later, when the CMB is liberated, you have that. It is at a certain temperature that the, you know, the universe cools and cools and cools. And then when a certain temperature is reached, the electrons can stick together with the proton. And that's when we have a phase transition and the plasma turns into a hydrogen gas. At that point in time, photons are free to move. Again, the natural choice of time variable is equal time is equal temperature. Because the temperature when that happened was everywhere the same. So it's natural to say that was the same time. So if we choose the space like the slicing of space-time into space like hypersurfaces such that equal temperature is equal time, then we arrive at a slicing of space-time where when the temperature dropped so that the phase transition was reached, then the phase transition happened equally at equal time for everybody. But there were fluctuations of curvature. So what that means is that the CMB was initially produced at this exact same temperature, because it was just the temperature that you have after the phase transition happened. So it was the CMB had the exact same temperature everywhere, but the curvature was not the exact same, which means that those photons of the CMB had to either climb out of a potential well or they came up down from a potential hill. And that, to the outside observer or to a far away later observer, looks as if at some regions it was a little hotter, in some regions it was a little colder. Even though you can also interpret this as saying, oh, it's actually that it was always the same temperature, but some photons climbed out of a potential well and some came down from a potential hill. Okay, so in any case, fluctuations of the Mukhanov variable give us local space-time expansion and therefore cooling or fluctuations, temperature spectrum in the CMB, as I just said. It depends on how you slice space-time, how you look at this. Now, fluctuations of the gravitational waves give us a gravitational wave background, and that should appear in the polarization spectrum of the CMB, and in particular, in the curl part of the polarization spectrum of the CMB. I think I mentioned that last time already. The polarization of the cosmic microwave background you can view as a vector field in the sky, and that vector field can be decomposed into a gradient part and a curl part. The gradient part has many origins. The curl part has essentially the gravitational waves as their origins, but even the gradient part can turn into a curl part given some type of contamination in between where it came from and where we observe. So unfortunately, the observation that was claimed by the BICEP2 collaboration turned out to be inconclusive as yet. But it would be a big deal if that was found. So next time, we will calculate the spectra for slow roll inflation. What is the spectrum of the Mukhanov variable? What's the spectrum of the gravitational waves? And therefore, what should we look out for experimentally? And that will be the last lecture on inflation. And then we will do the Unruh and Hawking effect. I think, you know, once we have done quantum field theory in curved space, we might as well. So next week we have a lecture on Tuesday, but not on Friday, because it's Good Friday.